Welcome to the podcast of this Brecan information session. Information sessions are recorded at the Brecan Resource Centre and can be borrowed in CD format from the Resource Library. Sessions are copyrighted and are for personal home use only. If you would like to know more about this and other sessions, please contact Brecan on 1300 781 500. We hope you enjoy this podcast. This session was recorded on the 23rd of April 2014 at the Brecan Resource Centre, located in Melbourne CBD. Aromatase inhibitors are a class of drugs used in the treatment of hormone receptor-positive breast and ovarian cancers in postmenopausal women. Christy Brown, co-head of the Metabolism and Cancer Laboratory at the Prince Henry's Institute, is a researcher with a particular interest in aromatase inhibitors. She will speak about the different types of aromatase inhibitors, how they work, their benefits and side effects, and recent developments in their use. We hope you find this session interesting.
So I'd like to start off by thanking Wendy and Brecan as an organisation for the very humbling invitation to come speak to you today. So I thought that before I started talking about aromatase inhibitors, I'd tell you a little bit about myself. You'll have noticed that I don't have an Australian accent. That's because I'm Canadian. I grew up there, and that's where I did my PhD. My PhD focused on understanding the regulation of estrogens in ovulation. So a little bit different to what I'm doing now. Around that time, my Aunt Ruth was diagnosed with breast cancer. She was 62 at the time, so she was postmenopausal, and she was diagnosed with hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. She was prescribed letrozole, an aromatase inhibitor, and I'll tell you a bit more about her story later on. That was a time that was very critical as far as personally in my life as well as professionally. It was a time where I needed to decide where I would undertake my postdoctoral fellowship, so further studies. And I felt like, although I really enjoyed the field of reproduction, I felt like I could probably make more of an impact in a field like breast cancer. So that's when I started searching around the globe to see where I could potentially do a postdoctoral fellowship. And it didn't take me long to find Professor Evan Simpson's laboratory. You probably haven't heard of him. He is a scientist, and he is one of the most humble people that I know. He was part of the group that was involved in initially identifying the aromatase gene. So if it wasn't for his team's work very early on, we wouldn't be where we are now with regards to aromatase inhibitors. So I've learned a great deal by working under his mentorship. At the end of last year, he retired, or at least as much as a scientist can actually retire. He's in Edinburgh at the moment, but we still are in contact. And since then, I've actually become head of the laboratory. The focus of my lab is understanding why estrogens are elevated in women's breasts after menopause, and also identifying alternatives to currently used endocrine therapy, like aromatase inhibitors. Because as most of you will know, the use of aromatase inhibitors is associated with a number of adverse events. And in order to be able to improve the quality of lives, of the lives of women who are being treated with these types of drugs, we need to be able to do more research in this field. So I am a laboratory-based scientist. I do not see patients, so I really don't feel comfortable providing advice with regards to the treatments that women should be taking. But I hope that by the end of my talk, you'll have a better understanding of what these aromatase inhibitors are, and maybe this is a starting point for conversations with clinical teams, as well as making informed decisions about these drugs. So, as you'll know, aromatase inhibitors are prescribed for the treatment of postmenopausal cancers of the breast and of the ovary. My talk today will focus more so on the breast cancer, but a lot of what I'm saying will be applicable to ovarian cancer. And please don't hesitate to ask me questions if you want clarifications with regards to the differences between the two. Now, one of the, critical aspects of being able to prescribe an aromatase inhibitor is the fact that the cancers need to be hormone receptor positive. So, and particularly estrogen receptor positive. So what happens is at the time of the diagnostic biopsy, that first piece of tissue that's taken, clinicians will have a look to see whether some of the markers are present, and this will actually dictate the type of therapy that is prescribed. Now, the estrogen receptor is the key one for when it comes to endocrine therapy, but pathologists will also look at progesterone receptor as well as HER2 status of these tumors, and all of these factors will help guide clinicians in their choice of therapy. So how is it actually done? I thought it might be interesting to show you what the pathologists actually see. So once the tissue is taken, it's placed in formalin, and this actually fixes the tissue, and it prevents the degradation of the markers that the pathologists are interested in looking at. The piece of tissue is then placed in paraffin or a wax block, and they can then section the tissue into very, very thin slices where they can look at individual cells within that piece of tissue. This is a technique called immunohistochemistry, so they actually use antibodies that are specific to the markers they're interested in this case the estrogen receptor, and where cells are positive for the estrogen receptor, the cells will become brown. So you can see here that the sample on the right is actually estrogen receptor negative. The blue staining that you see is just a marker to be able to identify the cells. Whereas the cells on the left here are estrogen receptor positive. You'll see that not all of the tissue is staining for the estrogen receptor, and that really highlights the heterogeneity of the breast tissue or the types of cells that are found within the breast. Now, all of the cells in this case are all of the tumor cells are actually staining for the estrogen receptor, but other cells within this area here are not. So this tumor would be considered estrogen receptor positive, but as little as 10% of cells need to stain for the estrogen receptor in order for a tumor to be considered hormone receptor positive. So that brings along with it a number of implications. At least 10%. But that will with that comes a number of implications, including the fact that some of the cells that are not estrogen receptor positive may not respond to therapy. And as a consequence, this might be one of the mechanisms whereby we're seeing resistance to therapy or recurrence later on. But that's really not what I'm here for today. Today, I really want to talk to you about the cells that will respond to therapy, the ones that are estrogen receptor positive and that will be a good target for aromatase inhibitors. So why is it important to know whether the estrogen receptor is expressed? Now, here I've depicted the estrogen receptor as this shape here in orange. And this basically represents a tumor cell. And obviously, it's a cartoon diagram, but we have the plasma membrane, which is on the outside of the tumor cell. And within that, we have a nucleus, and that's where all of our DNA is kept. Within the cytoplasm, we find the expression of the estrogen receptor until it comes in contact with estrogens. And in that case, once the estrogens bind, the estrogen receptor will go into the nucleus, where it can then bind to the DNA and stimulate the production of various proteins that are known to be involved in causing cell division and tumor growth. So this is really the mechanism whereby estrogens bind to the estrogen receptor and stimulate the growth of tumors. So you would understand that if the estrogen receptor is not being produced in cells, there's no point targeting estrogens and estrogen action. Now, before I go on to understanding estrogens in cancer, I thought it might be important to take a look back at what estrogens do that is good for us, because, you know, they're considered the bad guy when cancer comes about, but the healthy aspects of estrogens are really what dictate what the adverse effects are happening during the therapy. So it's really important to understand what they do normally in order to be able to understand what they do in pathology. So this is the chemical structure of estradiol, and that's actually the most potent estrogen that's produced by a woman's body. It binds with very high affinity to the estrogen receptor. In the premenopausal woman, so a woman of reproductive age, the main site of estrogen production is the ovary. And with every menstrual cycle, as the follicle that contains the egg grows, it produces more and more estrogen. And then once the egg is released and ovulation occurs, the estrogen levels decrease. So we go through these cyclic changes in estrogen levels, and these estrogens are readily measurable in the blood. They affect a number of tissues, and here are just a few examples. I'm a little bit biased in the sense because I come from a field that studies estrogens, but I have a feeling that estrogens play a role in most, if not all, of physiological processes. We know that in the brain, it helps maintain body temperature as well as help maintain cognitive function, so it improves memory capabilities, etc. It also acts on the heart and the liver. It helps prevent cardiovascular disease. It helps prevent lipid accumulation in the liver or fat accumulation in the liver. But it also has a number of important roles as far as reproduction is concerned, and you would understand that from the time of puberty, where estrogens are produced and stimulate the growth of the breast, the normal growth of the breast in order to allow lactation later on, to stimulating the growth of the uterus or the uterine lining to become receptive to a fertilized embryo, and also having effects on the brain to release hormones that will then stimulate ovulation. So all of these effects, in addition to the effect on bone, which is very important, I think many women will appreciate the role of estrogens in bone, as they're known to maintain bone density in women. So this is what happens prior to menopause. After menopause, however, the number of follicles, and these are the compartments that hold the eggs within our ovaries, this has decreased dramatically, and it gets to a point where ovulation no longer occurs. So as a consequence of that, estrogen levels also drop during the time of menopause. Women also produce androgens, and androgens for a long time have been thought to be as a male hormone, but they play a number of roles, of important roles in females as well. And these stay pretty much steady throughout a woman's lifespan. Estrogen levels, however, tend to drop, and it's this drop around the perimenopausal period that's accompanied by a number of changes that, you know, many women will be familiar with, including, you know, decreases in bone density, increased risk of cardiovascular disease, a number of different issues. Now, you're probably aware that the majority of breast cancers actually occur after the age of 50. And the majority of these are, in fact, dependent on estrogen. So if these estrogens are decreasing around the time of menopause, what's actually driving the growth of these tumors? Well, I thought that I'd show you a cross-section through the breast just to highlight the different types of cells that are present or the different types of tissues that are present within the breast. Now, we know that the mammary gland, which is composed of the lobes and the ducts, are the main source of milk, and this is also the main site of tumor development. But surrounding this mammary gland, there's quite a bit of fatty tissue. There's also quite a bit of fibrous tissue, and there are a number of different cells found in these areas of the breast, and these have been shown to really be the drivers of hormone-dependent cancer growth. So let's have a look at what aromatase does. So aromatase makes estrogens. It is a protein, it's an enzyme that's produced by some cells, including the fatty cells, and it converts the androgens into active estrogens. These estrogens can then bind to the estrogen receptor and stimulate the growth of tumors. So if we have a look at another immunohistochemistry, I'll remind you that the presence of the proteins we're interested in comes up as brown color. You'll see that. So this is just a piece of the tissue, and this is a DCIS, a ductal carcinoma in situ cancer. It's located on this side of the slide, and you'll see the blue color really just represents how densely packed these tumor cells are. On the left, you'll see these very round cells that seem to have white in the middle. These are adipocytes, or fat cells. These cells actually contain, you know, fat normally prior to this technique. And in the middle here, we see a layer of cells that stains the highest for aromatase, which are called the stromal cells. These are actually pre-fat cells. They can be converted into a mature fat cell. But what the tumor does is it actually produces inflammatory factors that stop these pre-fat cells from becoming fat cells. And the factors produced by the tumor also increase the production of aromatase. So what you end up with is this tumor driving its own supply of estrogen. And that supply of estrogen is very close to the tumor itself. And as a consequence, the estrogens then feed into the tumor and stimulate the growth. So you get this vicious cycle between these two different types of cells. So the aromatase inhibitors act at the level of the aromatase enzyme. They actually bind to this protein and prevent the androgens from being converted to estrogens. Another type of endocrine therapy is the selective estrogen receptor modulator, like tamoxifen or raloxifen. These drugs actually prevent the interaction of estrogens with the estrogen receptor. So you have two very different ways of achieving the same goal, which is to stop the actions of the estrogen receptor to stimulate the growth of cells. So let's go back to our chemical structures. I showed you estradiol before. I don't expect anyone to remember what this looks like. But it's just really to show you the similarity between estradiol and testosterone. Now, this testosterone is the typically male hormone. It's the anabolic steroids that these bodybuilders can use and increase muscle mass. And the only difference here is really at the level of this ring here. So the aromatase enzyme, as its name indicates, aromatizes the testosterone by making this into a cyclic ring. Now, although the differences seem quite small, it makes all the difference as far as binding to the estrogen receptor. This molecule will not bind to the estrogen receptor. Instead, it binds to another receptor called the androgen receptor. So understanding what aromatase does has actually led to the development of a number of aromatase inhibitors, because it was known that testosterone bound to the enzyme. One of the first class of inhibitors were the steroidal aromatase inhibitors, and exemestane or aromacin is an example of that. If you have a close look, you'll see that this chemical is very similar to testosterone. It would be in a 3D if you looked at it in 3D as well. And as a consequence of that, exemestane actually binds at the same place as testosterone would on the aromatase enzyme. And as a consequence, it prevents testosterone from binding and being converted. Exemestane is also an irreversible aromatase inhibitor. So it will bind to the aromatase enzyme, and then it will covalently attach itself to the enzyme. And that means it cannot be detached. And that makes it a suicidal aromatase inhibitor, which means that aromatase molecule will never be used to convert androgens into estrogens again. Now, another class of aromatase inhibitors are the non-steroidal aromatase inhibitors. And you'll see by their structure that they look nothing like the steroids that I've shown you here. The reason for that is that these inhibitors actually bind at a different spot on the enzyme. The enzyme requires oxygen and water in order to do what it's doing, and iron as well. And these compounds or these drugs actually bind to where the iron binding complex binds. So they are very different, and they are reversible. So they can bind and they can detach from the enzyme, but they are also very efficient at what they do. They are very good at inhibiting the activity of aromatase. So anastrozole or arimidex and letrozole or Femara are two of the non-steroidal aromatase inhibitors that are currently FDA approved for use in the treatment of hormone receptor positive breast cancer. So there have been a number of studies looking at differences between aromatase inhibitors. The largest adjuvant endocrine therapy trial to date is the MA27, and it actually found no differences between exemestane and anastrozole, so a steroidal and a non-steroidal inhibitor. So these drugs, for all intents and purposes, are very similar in the way that they stop the growth of tumors or prevent the recurrence of tumors. Now, if we compare aromatase inhibitors to tamoxifen, this is where we start seeing some differences. So this type of graph really represents whether one drug is favored over another. And the midline here would be that there would be no difference between both drugs. So if we see results on this side, that would suggest that the findings favor exemestane as a drug, or on this side it would favor tamoxifen as a drug. So a number of studies have now shown that aromatase inhibitors are superior to selective estrogen receptor modulators as far as the treatment of hormone receptor positive cancers. All of these types of cancers, and they have an impact on disease-free survival. This has been consistently shown study after study. Another way of showing this is by looking at proportion of women surviving on both treatments. This is over a 5-year period. We see that more women are surviving on exemestane than on tamoxifen. That being said, the current recommendations recommend treatment with tamoxifen followed by treatment with an aromatase inhibitor. And this serves to prolong the treatment or the time available for treatment in women diagnosed with cancer. The positive thing as well about having two classes of aromatase inhibitors, the steroidal and the non-steroidal ones, is that because they don't act at the same part of the enzyme or the protein, if you develop resistance to one, you're likely to still be sensitive to the other. So there is still scope to be able to have one aromatase inhibitor and then follow on to another one later on. Now, there are a number of factors that will impact efficacy of treatment, and this is really talking about those cells that would otherwise respond to aromatase inhibitors. Of course, there are some cells that are resistant, there are some cells that don't have the estrogen receptor, and of course, you know, these cells would not respond to therapy. But there are some factors in another situation, for example, this tumor would respond to therapy. One of them is increasingly affecting women is the fact that obesity will impact the efficacy of aromatase inhibitors. Obesity will affect serum estrogen levels as well as local production of estrogens within the fat. So if you think about estrogens being produced in fatty tissue, the more fat you have, the more estrogens you'll have. And as a consequence, it becomes harder for the aromatase inhibitors to completely suppress the levels of estrogens. That being said, if you'll remember the graph I showed you during the menopausal transition, the hormone changes actually predispose a woman to accumulate fat around their tummy area. So, you know, these hormones are really really not helping the situation at that time in a woman's life. Another difference in obese versus lean women is that the drugs will be metabolized differently in obese women, and in this case it actually favors the lean woman as far as whether the drug is available to the cells or not. One of the major issues with aromatase inhibitors today is compliance, and so many studies have looked at this, and it's been shown that 30 to 50% of women will become non-compliant in the treatment regimen by 4 years. And this is quite a substantial rate, considering that women who do not take the drug as it is prescribed will be at increased risk of the cancer coming back. So what are the main reasons affecting compliance? Well, you'll have heard about the adverse events that are associated with the use of aromatase inhibitors, the hot flashes, the mood disturbances, and from what I've heard, and I'd love to hear your feedback about this as well, is that the aches and pains are probably the major reason why women will stop using these, and that's due to the effects on the musculoskeletal system and involves arthralgia and an increased risk of fracture as well in women. So these women who are already at higher risk because of the fact that they are postmenopausal, exacerbate that risk by being on aromatase inhibitors. There's also been a suggestion that provider communication might impact on compliance. It's possible that the challenges to long-term adherence are not always very well discussed. And a patient's personal beliefs about their susceptibility to disease or recurrence, but also to the adverse events, will actually impact this. And I mentioned my Aunt Ruth at the beginning. She actually had the prescription for letrozole, but she chose not to take it. She, like many women here today, was very much aware of the adverse events which were associated with the use of these drugs. She felt like her quality of life was worth more than battling the disease. She was willing to take the risk, and she chose to take that risk in a very informed manner. She is one of the lucky ones that the cancer was gone and it never came back. So I think, you know, there's something to be said for women's intuition, but there's also something to be said for the science and the facts. So it's something that being aware of these situations is also very important. Now, if we compare aromatase inhibitors with tamoxifen, this is where tamoxifen wins out. This is not where tamoxifen wins out. This is where the aromatase inhibitors win out. Tamoxifen tends to cause a number of gynecological events. Is a risk factor for a number of gynecological events. It doesn't mean that women will develop them. It just favors the aromatase inhibitors. So I apologize for... Tamoxifen is not really that bad. So exemestane, for example, will be favored when compared to tamoxifen for the occurrence of all of these. Tamoxifen has been associated with an increased risk of endometrial hyperplasia, endometrial cancer, as well as polyps and fibroids. And the reason that this happens is that tamoxifen, although it inhibits and it stops the actions of the estrogen receptor in the breast, it actually stimulates the actions of the estrogen receptor in the uterus. And that's why it's called a selective estrogen receptor modulator. And that's why it increases the risk of these occurrences. So it's still something that women need to be aware of, because it's not a non-existent problem. This, again, is exacerbated by the obesity issue, because obese women are at higher risk of developing endometrial cancer to begin with. So if you add something like tamoxifen to the equation, it contributes to that increased risk as well. All right, so this is where tamoxifen is superior over exemestane, is as far as the fractures and the osteoporosis and the arthralgia, all of the very common complaints of women. But there is something that has come out from research over the past few years, and that is that women who tend to experience these types of adverse events actually tend to do better. They have lower recurrence rates. And that would probably suggest that estrogens are being suppressed to a level that's sufficient to stop the tumor from growing. And as a consequence, you're getting the occurrence of these adverse events. So considering all of these adverse events and what contributes to compliance, scientists strongly believe that there is scope to develop alternatives to these therapies. It is important to be able to improve the quality of life of women who are being treated for this disease, as we are doing quite well as far as decreasing mortality. Now we need to focus on making sure that the women who do develop the disease can manage it more appropriately. So in 2009, there was a major breakthrough as far as aromatase is concerned. The crystal structure of the protein was elucidated by Debashis Ghosh. And this is just a cartoon diagram of what that looks like. So this might not mean much to you looking at it, besides being maybe a pretty picture, but it comes about from the examination of a single crystal of the aromatase enzyme by X-ray crystallography. And what it allows us to do is to specifically pinpoint where different molecules are interacting with the protein. So it tells us at this spot in particular, we're seeing interaction with this area of testosterone. And what this allows us to do is be able to better design drugs so that they interact very specifically with these enzymes, and perhaps be able to develop additional drugs that will perhaps one day be able to target it with fewer side effects. Genome-wide association studies have become very important in the last little while. What these are, and you might have heard the news on the news yesterday about a new gene signature that's been identified to see whether women would be at increased risk of recurrence for breast cancer. What this is taking blood from women who are diagnosed and treated for breast cancer and seeing what their genes are telling the clinician. So we can actually look at whether certain genes will, you know, are have different mutations or are expressed differently, and this really allows us to see whether a woman is more likely to develop a secondary cancer or have cancer recurrence. But there have also been studies recently looking at whether there is a gene signature that predicts whether a woman will develop adverse events. So there's a lot we can do with this type of technology. Where my lab is focused is trying to identify a breast-specific inhibitor of aromatase, and I'm going to get into a bit more technical slides at this stage to try to tell you how we and others are trying to do that. Now, this is a cartoon diagram of what the aromatase gene looks like. It has these yellow bars here that actually codes for the protein part, and then on the DNA you have these areas to the left here, which actually dictate whether the protein will be produced or not. The aromatase gene is more complex than a lot of other genes, but we can use that to our advantage. The brain actually uses this blue area here to drive the expression of aromatase. The bones utilize an area called promoter 1.6, which isn't on this diagram. And the breast utilizes this promoter here, this box here, as well as 1.3, so these two together. So by knowing that, we can actually start looking at stopping the production of aromatase specifically within the breast and within the fat and leave the bone and the brain unaffected. What I didn't mention is that prior to menopause, the ovaries are really the main site of estrogen production. But after menopause, when these no longer produce it, our bodies compensate for that by really ensuring that every tissue that requires estrogens produces its own estrogen. So the estrogens are not readily measurable in the serum or the plasma of women after menopause, but the estrogens are still acting. So the bone produces its own estrogen, the brain produces its own, the fat does as well, etc. So two of the proteins that we found that may be involved in regulating aromatase specifically within the breast are LKB1 and AMP kinase. And a scientist like to use words like these are the master regulators of energy homeostasis, because these proteins are actually involved in regulating a number of processes that regulate glucose uptake, fat deposition, etc. So these proteins are key sensors of nutrient balance, and they're very important when we're studying obesity. Well, we found that these proteins also inhibit estrogen biosynthesis. And that makes sense, right? If estrogen biosynthesis is occurring in the fat, why wouldn't proteins that are involved in regulating fat be involved in regulating estrogens as well? So without going into too much detail here, we found that this other protein here, called CRTC2, binds to the breast-specific promoter of aromatase. And that really drives the production of aromatase in the breast. We found that AMP kinase actually stops the actions of this protein. It prevents it from binding to the aromatase gene. But we know that factors that are produced in obesity, but also by cancer cells, like prostaglandins, will stop the actions of AMP kinase, and as a consequence, increase the binding of this protein to the breast promoter and drive the production of aromatase. So this was one of the first molecular links between obesity and breast cancer in women. Now, we know that prostaglandins are synthesized in obesity because obesity is a chronic state of inflammation, but also by tumor cells, which are very inflamed as well. And we know that drugs like aspirin target this signaling pathway. So there is also scope to be looking at drugs like aspirin in the context of decreasing aromatase and estrogen production in the breast. Now, one of the drugs that we've become interested over the last few years is metformin, and you may or may not have heard about it. It's received a lot of attention in the media. It is the most commonly prescribed anti-diabetic drug. It's been around for a really long time, and as a consequence of that, it's actually off patent, which makes it relatively cheap. The reason people have become interested in it is because population studies and observational studies have shown that diabetic women who are taking metformin are at decreased risk of developing breast cancer. Metformin has also been shown to decrease cancer-associated mortality in these women, and retrospective trials have shown that it also increases the pathological complete response to neoadjuvant chemotherapy. A more recent study was a neoadjuvant study, so prior to surgery, women were given metformin for 2 weeks, and that was sufficient to cause a decrease in the growth of their tumor cells. So it is receiving a lot of attention. We thought it was interesting because we knew that it also acted on AMP kinase. So we knew that this was decreased in cancer. So we figured if we can find something that stimulates it again, maybe we can stop estrogen production in these cells. And that's exactly what we found. We found that metformin decreases or stimulates this protein and decreases the production of the breast-specific aromatase, but does not affect the bone-specific aromatase. And this is supported by observational studies showing that diabetics that are treated with metformin have no adverse effects on bone or joint stiffness, etc. So a number of studies, clinical studies, have been started over the last few years, but what I do need to make sure that I convey is that metformin is approved by the FDA for the treatment of diabetes, but it's still considered investigational when it comes to breast cancer therapy. So this is just really to give you some insight as to the type of work that we do from bench to bedside. It does take a lot of time for these things to come to fruition. That being said, there is an international large phase 3 trial that's going on at the moment. My understanding is that Australia was wanting to be involved, but I'm not sure if they have or not. It involves a number of different countries, and it's largely dependent on funding, whether Australia has been involved or not. But this phase 3 trial is to compare invasive disease-free survival of patients with early-stage breast cancer treated with metformin versus placebo in addition to their standard adjuvant therapy. So women will be given the opportunity to supplement their current treatment with metformin, or obviously they'll be randomized, so being part of this study. Now, two of the studies that I'm directly involved in have come about as a result of our studies in the laboratory, and that's the SetUp AIM study, which is a window of opportunity neoadjuvant study. And in this case, and this is different to many of the other metformin studies out there, we're really interested in seeing the effects on aromatase and estrogen specifically within the breast. So that's what we'll be looking at in postmenopausal women with hormone receptor positive breast cancer. The second one is actually working with healthy women. So these are women who are going to undergo breast reduction surgery, and we want to see whether metformin will decrease the estrogens in these women's breasts prior to their surgery in order to be able to understand whether we could potentially use metformin in the prevention setting for women that are at higher risk. So that is currently underway as well. Now, these are my current collaborators. You'll see that there are a number of them. Evan I've put here because he is, for all intents and purposes, retired, but he's still a very important part of our research program. You'll see that basic research requires a large team and a large international team. We collaborate with pathologists, with breast surgeons, with medical oncologists, and none of that would be possible without funding. As well as women who donate their tissue for research. That's a very important part of the work that we do, and without it, we wouldn't be able to do it. So I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'm very open to any type of question that you have. Yes, my understanding of HRT is that it has a lot of beneficial effects within the first five years of menopause, so during that perimenopausal period. If that's extended beyond that, then that's when you start getting, you know, the increased risk of cancer, et cetera. What it does is it actually it slows down a lot of the negative effects that happen during the menopausal transition. So it'll decrease weight gain. So it kind of smooths things out a little bit. And my impression is that there's still, because of that initial study where everyone stopped prescribing it, it's taking much longer to reintroduce it. I work closely with an endocrinologist, and all of them feel that there is a place for HRT, but women need to be informed of the risks. But my understanding is that it's during those first few years there is a benefit. Longer term, there's still an increased risk of cancer. That's right. And up until recently, it was very difficult to measure them. Now we have better technology that's more sensitive, more precise, and they can measure estrogen levels. That being said, it doesn't measure the tissue levels, and a lot of researchers are trying to go towards that, but it's so expensive to be able to measure those levels that I don't see it becoming part of the diagnostic regimen. My understanding is that there's a standard dose being given to women, no matter, you know, their weight, exactly. I would have to agree with you. From my point of view, it would make more sense. But unfortunately, there haven't been that many studies to be able to guide clinicians into what doses to give to women of different weight. I think that's definitely a need. There's a need to be able to do these randomized studies in women that... Yeah, it would make complete sense. I'm not aware, and my understanding is that really the treating oncologists, there are no guidelines. It really goes by their knowledge base and the information that they have, how they prescribe the different therapies. I don't know. The only thing I can do is ask my clinical colleagues, why aren't you doing this? Why isn't this happening? But it also becomes difficult from the point of view of sheer numbers of women that these people still see. I had no... I didn't know how much of an impact there was until I started working with these clinicians, how many patients they actually see every week, how many women go through the system. And there is a need to be able to identify, you know, which women will be better treated. I wonder if organizations can provide these types of booklets to the treating oncologists and the... My understanding is, although there's a lot less that's been done with regards to aromatase inhibitors and ovarian cancer, the studies to date have been very promising. I think up to 40% of women are responding to aromatase inhibitors that are candidates. That's good. So none of the adverse effects that women with breast cancer experience? As far as dietary recommendations, I think with a lot of these hormone-dependent cancers, the only thing I know is that obviously obesity, lifestyle, all of these things will impact, because obesity and lifestyle impact hormones. And as soon as you're talking about a hormone-dependent cancer, you know, the indication would be to have, you know, a healthy lifestyle. Whether or not enough has been done in the field of ovarian cancer to be able to say definitively that obesity, you know, decreases the efficacy of aromatase inhibitor, I don't think that's been done yet. But intuitively, I would say, you know, in any situation, you know, the decreasing those levels of hormones. There have been studies in breast cancer, for example, where increased physical activity will decrease the risk, will improve the response to therapy as well, and there's all of these different aspects. Sorry, what was your last question? Yeah, there are a number of studies. These studies are always a bit more controversial. It's difficult to know, you know, because you have to understand that these phytoestrogens have much lower affinity for the estrogen receptor than the pure estrogens. And how much of them do you have to consume in order to have an effect? And there is, you know, some suggestion that, you know, phytoestrogens like soy might help with the menopausal transition, but may also increase the risk of cancers. But I'm not sure how solid that data is, and that's a difficult question. I don't know. I really don't know. It does. And I think there's more to it than that. Yeah, I think there are different risk factors that will contribute to, you know, women of different ethnicities developing cancer. There's been a rise in the incidence of... There has been a higher incidence of breast cancer in Asian communities over the last couple of decades, and many people are suggesting that the diet has changed to a more westernized diet. But more studies need to be done to confirm anything like that. Compared to tamoxifen, well, they're two very different drugs to begin with, tamoxifen and Arimidex. The fact that it's reversible, if anything, you know, the exemestane, for example, aromycin, is not reversible, and what it does is it actually kills the protein, so it prevents any further conversion to estrogens. Arimidex, if you have, you know, if you take it away, that enzyme will start working again. So compared to tamoxifen, it's very different, though it's very difficult for me to say, you know, which one is better as far as ovarian. You won't. The difference is that it's acting at a different spot, and it comes down to how the enzymes actually work. So aromatase will bind the substrate testosterone and convert it to something else. So there is scope there to be able to make it irreversible. The non-steroidal inhibitors will bind on a different spot of the enzyme. They're still very efficient. They compete out with a heme moiety, so with the iron moiety. So they still prevent it from working. But with anything, you know, even the irreversible inhibitor, aromatase will continue to be produced. As long as the tumor is producing factors that stimulate aromatase being produced, you'll get new aromatase proteins there. So if you decide to stop exemestane, the ones that it was in contact with will not work, but the new ones will still work. So there is still... So they're just very, very different. But essentially they do the same thing. They stop the activity of the enzyme. Tamoxifen is different, though. It is different in the sense that it's acting at the level of the estrogen receptor. Raloxifen is an interesting one as well, and my feeling is that it's not prescribed very often. It does have benefits over tamoxifen, but I haven't brought any of that information as well. Tamoxifen and raloxifen have fewer effects on the bone. Obviously, they don't inhibit aromatase there, and they don't inhibit estrogen action in the bone. It would be an advantage. Definitely. That's one of the areas that's the hardest one, and we usually, when we talk about these things as scientists, we usually say possible cognitive defects, because there haven't been enough studies, and it's really hard to study this type of thing, because as a woman ages, their memory changes anyway. And the same thing with bone, but with bone it's been easier to actually measure it, because it's something that can be, you know, physically measured. With memory, but it would make sense. There have been... Yes, or both, or... Yeah. Yes. My understanding was that clinicians will sometimes prescribe things like bisphosphonates. Do they? Bisphosphonates to decrease bone loss, but I think it really depends on the treating clinician. I don't know. I wouldn't be able to tell you, because I don't feel comfortable being in this position and saying, you know, to take supplements. But I think. Because they're known, there are things that the clinicians can suggest. I think communication is a very important one. My understanding is that they should be there to help. So if there's complaints of joint pain, possibly, you know, an anti-inflammatory might be prescribed. And vitamin D has received a lot of attention over the last little while. But maybe it's gone to an extreme as well. I think some people are taking a lot of vitamin D in order to be able to prevent something that, you know, the vitamin D might actually be causing negative effects as well. So I don't know. There must be benefits. A normal diet, exercise, should cover all of the nutritional requirements. But
would there be a vitamin that you would suggest to stand right away?
I'm not aware of any of those. Mm. Let me just go here first.
I might have got some questions. Three more questions. If you have strong ER positives, does that mean that the treatment will be more effective?
Not necessarily. Some of the other markers that are looked at are the progesterone receptor, for example. So if we go back to the uterus, estrogens stimulate the growth of the uterus by stimulating the production of progesterone receptor. So that's the same thing in our breast tissue. So estrogens via the estrogen receptor will stimulate the production of the progesterone receptor. When you have an ER-positive, PR-negative tumor, there's something not quite right there. The estrogen receptor isn't signaling normally. So either the estrogens aren't getting to the estrogen receptor and are not stimulating the progesterone receptor, or the estrogen receptor isn't binding to the right part of the DNA to stimulate the expression. So these types of things can give treating physicians an indication as to whether a tumor is more likely to respond or not. I'm not aware of the intensity. The thing is with immunohistochemistry, it can vary from laboratory to laboratory. The longer you leave the reagents on the slide, the stronger the signal will be. So if one lab does 10 minutes and the other one does 15, you're going to get a stronger signal in the 15-minute one. So it's very difficult to know. There may have been studies looking at the actual expression of the protein by other methods to be able to determine that, but I'm not aware of them. And the estrogen receptor itself is not a sure thing to determine whether the endocrine therapy will work, because the estrogen receptor might act via other mechanisms that are completely estrogen independent. So if you stop the aromatase enzyme and stop estrogens being produced, it can actually still signal via other mechanisms, and that's one form of resistance that has been shown. I wouldn't say that. I think it's very difficult to make generalizations with these things. There has been a suggestion that increased side effects is associated with increased efficacy, but it doesn't mean that the opposite is true. There will be a proportion of women that have no side effects that are responding perfectly well to therapy. There's always a proportion of women that are, you know, an exception to the rule, and that will make up a large proportion of women. Oh, so the proportion of women who will actually get the adverse effects, or the proportion of women who will respond better on tamoxifen? Adverse effects. From what I've read, it's quite variable, but it is around those 30 to 50%. It seems to be one of the main complaints of women taking aromatase inhibitors. So it's a large proportion of women that do seem to experience them. The aromatase inhibitors will inhibit aromatase everywhere in the body. So they'll inhibit the bone aromatase as well as the brain aromatase, whereas tamoxifen will only stop the effects of the estrogen receptor. And because it's different in different tissues, like I said, in the breast it stops the actions, whereas in the womb it stimulates. In the bone it doesn't actually have detrimental effects. So that's how it's different. There are new estrogen therapies that are being developed at the moment that would allow treatment of menopausal symptoms and decrease the risk of cancer, but those are really just starting to be explored, and I think there's a lot of, you know, interest in these types of drugs at the moment.
Hmm.
can have a look at. I can, yeah. Well, this is the study that was done when you compare exemestane with tamoxifen. So about 75% of women who took tamoxifen for 5 years survived. The risk of recurrence was also, well, this is taking into account the risk, well, this is just survival rate, sorry. Whereas with exemestane, it's about 5 to 7% higher. What I was telling you before is there is scope to be able to extend therapy with a different type of therapy. And like I said, what's being recommended at the moment is to start off on tamoxifen and follow it up with an aromatase inhibitor. And that seems to be giving a lot of very good, solid results. The estrogen receptor sensitive cells to come back, and then they're sensitive again. So it's to prevent desensitization of the tumors. So that intermittent taking, that's still being explored. There are clinical studies that are underway where that intermittent exposure to aromatase inhibitors may prove more beneficial than the long term, because cells that are long term estrogen deprived take on different characteristics. So if you kind of keep them in that state of estrogen responsiveness, then you can actually halt the tumor. There have also been studies, you're correct, of looking at longer treatment, and they do seem to be showing some encouraging results, definitely. So they would be, I would imagine, they would be aware of the literature and the studies that are out there. If not, you know, maybe ask questions. And if you have read up on something, you know, bring it to their attention. Maybe they're aware, maybe they're not aware of it, and they'd be interested, or they would be able to clarify whether it might be appropriate or not. I think discussion and, you know, communication is key here. Hmm.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to Breakhand's podcasts or browse existing ones at our website, www.breakhand.org.au.